We are talking about the temple today in our study on the road to redemption. We're talking about the temple, God with us. Now, before we get into the text this morning, we're going to do kind of a little review. For those of you who may not have been here, or the most of you who were here who've just totally forgot that sermon. But several weeks ago, we talked about the Tower of Babel. Okay, we talked about the Tower of Babel. And one of the things we talked about at the Tower of Babel is that that tower that was built was not so much for the people to get to God, but as an invitation for God to come down to a temple that they had built because they wanted God's presence with them so they would not be scattered. You remember we said they didn't want to be scattered, and so they had ulterior motives, and they had invited God down to stay with them. And we talked about that their motives were not pure, and that God, they were trying to initiate a relationship that God was not ready to restart. And that was one of the things that was a problem at the Tower of Babel, why the people were scattered, because they took that initiative without God's permission. So today what we're going to be looking at is God kind of reinitiating this relationship. This God reinitiating this relationship with man. And if you remember back in the garden, God's presence, God walked in the garden with man and woman. Remember he said he would come down in the cool of the day and walk with them. His presence was there with them. And then they were kicked out of the garden and therefore kicked out of his presence. So we're going to pick up today talking, before we really get into the temple, we're going to talk some about the tabernacle. And so we're going to be looking at a passage from Exodus chapter 40. Now, if you are so inclined that you would like to see all the dimensions and the specifics of how many curtains there were and how many gold rings for each curtain and how many walls, if you want all that information, it is in Exodus. Feel free to read it at your leisure, but I'm not going to read all of that for you today. We're just going to start in chapter 40, verse 33. It says, and really, we're really focusing on the last part of that first sentence. Thus Moses finished the work. So if you want to go back and see what the work was, go back and look at the previous couple of chapters of Exodus. It says, but Moses finished the work. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Throughout all their journeys, whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the sons of Israel would set out. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out until the day when it was taken up. For throughout all their journeys, the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and there was fire in it by night in the sight of all the house of Israel. Okay, so this is this text is talking about, as the children of Israel have come out of Egypt, that now God is ready to establish his presence with them. But here's the problem. They're nomads, okay? And so the tabernacle was a tent. Now, I want to kind of begin with a question as we kind of get into this text. I want you just to think about this for a minute, because this is really important thematically to the road to redemption. Mankind was created to be in God's presence. We know that from the garden, right? Okay. So here's the question: why does God tell Moses to build a tabernacle while they're in the wilderness? Why do they need a tabernacle? Why do they need God's presence with them while they're in the wilderness? Now, that's kind of an interesting question, because you think about, well, okay, if God's omnipotent, how many of you have ever heard that God is everywhere? Right? We've heard that forever, right? So if God's everywhere all the time, why would he need a tabernacle to be built out in the wilderness that can be packed up and moved? And why would he, when he inhabits the tabernacle, why would he do so that in the daytime, there was a cloud hanging over it, so you'd know he was home. And at night, there was a fire burning in it, so you'd know he's there. Why would you need all that? It seems like a lot of excessive stuff for a God who's omnipotent and all-present and is everywhere. Why do you need that stuff? Children of Israel, thanks Jim. Children of Israel needed a reminder. Okay? How many of you have ever said that you would not forget something and then you forgot it? I have to tell you, I'm one of those people that I enjoy commercials almost as much as the shows. Which is why I try to make sure I keep a remote close to me, because my wife will mute commercials when they come on just because she doesn't want to hear them. But some of them I find grandly amusing, more so amusing sometimes than the shows I'm watching. How many of you have seen the Progressive commercial where the husband and wife are going canoeing and he said he was going to bring the life jackets? And he blamed it on her. And so they throw the challenge flag and the little Progressive guy comes out with the replay thing. And she says, I love that part when you said, obviously, I won't forget the life jackets. And then they now confirmed it was his fault, which any man watching that commercial knew that when the commercial started, that they're gonna blame that on the man. But we've all done that, right? We've all said we're not going to forget something, and then we forget. I mean, just think about how many Americans, you remember 9/11? Remember we were never going to forget 9/11? Yeah, how long did that last? And before 9/11, we were never going to forget Pearl Harbor. And I'm sure before Pearl Harbor, there were other things that we were never going to forget. We do these things that we say, well, I'm not going to forget this. How many of you write yourself notes? Which, by the way, is the most amusing thing in the world, because what's the first thing you do with a note after you write it? You lose it. What was it? Yeah, so what you do is you write yourself a note that tells you where you're putting the note, right? That's kind of who we are, okay? Anytime the children of Israel questioned whether or not God was with them, All they had to do was look over to the tabernacle, right? So all they had to do was look to the tabernacle. Now, remember, these are people who had been distanced and separated from God while they were in Egypt. And so this whole thing is being done so that they will have confidence and safety and assurance in knowing that God is nearby, that there is a physical manifestation of God nearby. Now, on a more personal note, and I don't really want you to answer this one out loud as much as just think about it. How many of you have ever gone through something in your life where you did not feel God's closeness? Now, I would guess most of us in this room have had something that has transpired in our life, whether it's a medical issue or a family issue or a personal issue or a work issue, or a financial issue. We've had something transpire in our life where we felt that God was not close to us. That we felt like he was really distant, and we wanted to feel his presence, but we just didn't. And I don't want to get into the theological ramifications of whose fault that is, but I would guess most of us have gone through that. This moment where God did not feel close. So for the children of Israel, what became really important was this idea that any time we're not certain that God is aware of what's going on, any time we are not certain if he knows the danger we're in or knows what our needs are, all we have to do is look at the tabernacle, and hovering over it during the day is going to be this cloud. And if that cloud is there, that means God is there. That his physical presence is dwelling with them. And at night, if you can see the fire burning inside the tabernacle, then you know God is there. And so this becomes a very important concept, because as we get to Christmas, some of the key terms at Christmas, I think it's Emmanuel. Anybody know what Emmanuel means? God with us, right? Oh, come, oh, come, Emmanuel. And that word literally translates into God with us. And so we start to piece this thing together, and we understand that is when Christ comes, and I don't want to spoil the Christmas sermon, so I won't say any more about that. I'd hate for you to not feel like you need to come Christmas Day because you already know the sermon. So just forget I said that. But we understand the importance of this idea that God's ultimate goal is to be back with us in a personal way. And so this concept of the tabernacle is kind of one of the first steps in this process. But ultimately, the tabernacle, as nice as it is still a tent. Any of you ever stayed in a tent? I just want to tell you that no matter how nice you make a tent, you know what it is? It's a tent. It is a tent. It is an outdoor dwelling that is not made for me. I am not a tent guy. I don't really enjoy sleeping on the ground. I didn't mind it so much when I was young, but as I've gotten older and other things like weight have become more of an issue, I don't even like sleeping on the bunks at camp, and those are in a structure. So a tent, no matter how opulent you make it, no matter how many gold rings you put, and no matter what the curtains are made out of, and no matter how fancy it is, for the children of Israel, when they looked at it, you know what it still was? It's a tent. Now let me ask you a question. How many of you think God deserves better than a tent? Most of us probably, probably. That would be the goal at some point, to do something better than a tent. So at this point, we're gonna segue over to 1 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles, this is chapter 28, and now we're gonna be listening to some stuff about King David. It says, then King David rose to his feet and said, listen to me, my brethren. So he's called all the children of Israel together. He says, listen to me, my brethren and my people. I have intended to build a permanent home for the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God. So David says, I want him to have a place to live. And by the way, anybody know what David has just finished building? What? His palace. He's like, I got a palace. I don't know that it's right that I've got a palace and God's still in a tent. That makes sense, right? I don't know how I feel about that. I've got a palace. God has a tent. I feel like I should build God a palace. I should build him some nice place. I had intended to build a permanent home for the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God. So if I had made preparations to build it, but God said to me, you shall not build a house for my name because you are a man of war and of shed blood. Okay. David's a warrior. He shed a lot of blood. He's killed a lot of people in combat. Not just Goliath, but he's killed a lot of people in combat. And God says, nope, not you. You're a man of war. You have shed blood. All right, next slide, please. So in verse 6, he says, he said to me, your son Solomon is the one who shall build my house and my courts, for I have chosen him to be a son to me, and I will be a father to him. So in 1 Chronicles, we see that David wants to build this incredible temple for God. He wants his presence to be in Jerusalem. And by the way, now what's interesting is a lot of times we call this the first temple. This actually isn't the first temple. It's the first temple in Jerusalem. There were other things in the Old Testament that are referred to as temples. There was one at Shiloh. and a couple of other places. If you search temple in the Old Testament, you'll see that that word appears in reference to God in some occasions before David. But this is certainly the first one that's built in Jerusalem. This is going to be the big main temple for the Jews. So he's going to build this massive temple in Jerusalem for God so that his presence can be there. Now, let's go back to the Tower of Babel. Why do we want God's presence in our capital? Why do we want him living here with us? What does God provide us? Protection. He provides us protection. He provides us safety. He provides us comfort. We feel empowered. We feel empowered when we're in the presence of God. Now, I want you to take a minute and think about this. For those of you who are thinking, well, Stuart, that sounds childish. If they're God's people and they're his people and he's their God, why do they need a building to feel like God's there? Now, if you're asking yourself that question, I want you to take a minute and think about how we talk about the church building. How many of you have ever heard that God's presence lives in this building? Okay, let me go ahead and help you. It doesn't. When you turn out the lights and leave, God doesn't come in and put his bed up and sleep under the communion table. This is you know what this is when you're not here? It's an empty building. It's an empty building. When God's presence is in this building, you know why it's in this building? Because it came with you. It came with you. But we've all heard this, right? We've grown up hearing this. Oh, this is the Lord's house and it's his building. And we go to church so that we can be in the presence of God. You don't come to church to be in God's presence. You come to church to worship with other people in his presence. But you're in God's presence. And by the way, this may disturb some of you. You're in God's presence all the time. Everywhere you go, everything you do, you're in his presence. Now, it's any time you preach on this topic, you have to be careful because people will take what you're saying and run the wrong direction with it. I'm not saying that the church isn't important. I'm not saying that the building isn't special. I'm not saying it shouldn't be nice. I'm not saying anything bad about stained glass or the lovely chandeliers. I'm just saying that much like the people in the Old Testament, we put a lot of emphasis on brick and mortar structures when God's presence has a lot less to do with those and a lot more to do with us. And this has been an issue on this road to redemption since the garden, right? This has been a problem for man since the garden, that we've got this mentality that we're going to, and here's, by the way, here's the convenient thing about putting God in a church building. You know why it's nice to put God in a church building? Because guess where that is? Guess what that means? When you want him, what do you know to do? I just go to church. I'm going to go to church today and get me a little Jesus, because that's where he's at. It's like we run to the grocery store to get stuff. It's like I run to the grocery store to get a turkey, and I run to the church to get some Jesus. How do you know he's there? Because that's where I keep him. Lock him up there, keep him there, know where he's at. So when I want him, I can go get him. And that's kind of how the children of Israel were. They looked at that tabernacle. By the way, how often do you think people looked at the tabernacle to see if he was still there? You think people ever did? You ever think people went, yeah, okay, he's still there. I feel fairly confident there were people who did that daily. They looked over there and checked to see if God's presence was there. By the way, how many of you ever feel less inclined to misbehave when you feel like you're in God's presence? One of my favorite things I have ever seen in my life. I'll just say this was not here, and I will leave it at that. Somebody came up to me once in a church building and said, Stuart, I got a joke to tell you. I said, cool, come outside. I can't tell you in the building. Now I want you to take a minute and wrap your head around the stupidity of that statement. Now some of you are going, I've done that. Hey, own it. Okay? Own it. If you've ever done it, own it. That was kind of stupid. Because the God who can hear you in here can hear you out there. And if he's offended by what you say in here, he's probably going to be offended by what you said out there. In fact, I would almost bet you that no time in the history of humanity has God ever said, "Whew, man, I'm glad you didn't say that in the building. I'd have smote you. But since you said it in the parking lot, that's a good one." I'm almost certain that's never happened. I'm almost certain that's never happened. But we think that way. We think that way. We have built into our concept of worship this idea. Now, I'm not making fun of anybody. I'm entitled to my opinion. And since I'm up here, I get to share it. One of my least favorite phrases in Christianity is when people say, they'll start talking about something, and then they'll say, "And then God showed up." Like he wasn't there. If you start worshiping and you think God isn't there, then he just shows up in the middle of it like he's late, I don't think you understand the concept of God very much. But we hear these things all the time. People say this stuff, and it makes sense to them. And it's like, "Oh, I can't say that in the church." Or, "Man, I really need to pray. I need to go to the church so I can pray." This all goes back to the period of the tabernacle and the temple. Now, I want to be clear. God wanted the tabernacle built. Okay, he wanted it built. He wanted the people to see his presence in the building. But let me ask you a question. Why do you think God wanted to put his presence in a building in front of those people that they couldn't get to? By the way, does anybody know what happened to somebody who went into the tabernacle to enter God's presence? They got smote, smitten, smoted. They died. In fact, it was so dangerous to go into God's presence that they actually started tying a rope around the waist of the high priest on the one time a year he could go into the Holy of Holies in case he dropped dead in God's presence so they could pull him out because nobody was going to go in after the body. That's how dangerous it was to be in God's presence. Now, I want you to take a minute and think about this. How far have we come from a time when if we entered into God's physical presence, we died, to the time where God's physical presence dwells in us? We've come a long way, haven't we? But in the tabernacle, you couldn't enter into the Holy of Holies. And in the temple, it was the same way. You've got this Holy of Holies that's been put in place. And if anyone walks into it, if anybody really wants to go into the presence of God, they drop dead. So this is a problem. This is a problem. So it brings us to this idea of God with us. Okay? God with us. And one of the things you'll notice in this long series that we're doing on the road to redemption is that God tends to do things in stages. He does them in small steps. And so we've seen what happened at the Tower of Babel, and now we've come kind of full circle as we've moved out of Egypt. Now what has God done? I'm going to give you my presence, sort of. I'm going to put my presence in a building so that you can see it. I'm going to put it there so you can see it. There's going to be a cloud and a pillar of fire so you can see that I'm there. But guess what you can't do? You can't approach it. You can't approach it. And when you finally conquer the promised land and you finally conquer Jerusalem and you get a man who's not a man of war, when you get David's son in place, I'm going to let him build me a temple. It's going to be spectacular. It's going to be amazing. And if you want to go back into Chronicles and read the description of the temple, it's absolutely amazing. And in Second Chronicles, I think it's chapter 7, they go through and list all the sacrifices that were made when the temple was dedicated, and it's absolutely awe-inspiring to read. But what's going to happen is God is going to transition from this tent, this nomadic home that can be torn down and moved from place to place. God is finally going to have a permanent home in the temple in Jerusalem. And by the way, does anybody know how long that temple stays there? When the Babylonians conquered Judah in 586 BC, they destroy it. And today, as far as we know, there's not a single stone standing remaining from the original temple. Now, let me ask you a question. Why did the Babylonians destroy the temple when they conquered Judah? Why would they destroy the temple? It had no military purpose, so why do you destroy the temple? Because it signified that your God is not here anymore. We defeated your God. We destroyed his house. We destroyed his home. His presence isn't with you anymore. You are a defeated people. That's the message that was sent when you destroyed somebody's temple. So the temple was destroyed so that the children of Israel would know that their God had been vanquished by the Babylonians. That's what the Babylonians wanted them to think. We're going to destroy this temple. We're going to tear it down. We're going to destroy it so that it can't be rebuilt. We're going to take this thing down and we're going to communicate to you that the presence of your God is gone from you. Now here's the question. Why was the presence of God gone from the children of Israel? Was it because of Nebuchadnezzar? No, it's because they had chosen not to be in his presence. They had rejected God's presence. They had rejected his commands. They had rejected his instructions. They had rejected his laws. They had rejected his ways. They had adopted other gods. And like most people do, if you go visit somebody and you feel like you're not welcome, what eventually do you do? You leave. You leave. But all of this is done to kind of build towards the future. And I want you to think about how easy it is for us to take for granted the idea that in the Old Testament, the presence of God was out there and you could see it, but you couldn't reach it. Any of you ever had something that was really, you really wanted that was just out of reach? When I was a kid, I had a dog named Buck. No relation to Charles. And by the way, just in case you think I'm making fun of Charles, I named him Buck before I ever met Charles. This is, I was a kid. Buck lived in town. We had a house in town, so Buck was on a, we had this humongous long chain, and he was chained. He had this piece of cable that went across the yard so he could run all up and down the yard. But it had its limits, and my cat, Pooh, knew right where the limit was. And Pooh would stop 3 feet outside of the length of the reach of that dog and just bathe herself. Just right. And he's, and he's just barking and growling. And she's just sitting there just, you know. Until the day came when we had to replace Buck's chain. And the new chain was like 10 feet longer. Now, I'm almost certain the dog didn't know that the chain was longer. I am absolutely certain the cat didn't know. But that was a magical time right there in my yard when that cat was sitting there giving herself a bath and the dog lunged and the chain didn't catch him and he landed on her. And noises ensued, fur. I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure the dog won. He might have lost that battle, but he enjoyed every minute of it. And that poor cat was never the same after that. She questioned everything about her reality. But we know what it means to want something and it's just in reach. And we just think, man, if I could just reach it, it would change my life. If I could just get that promotion, or if I could just get that date with that person, or if I could just get this thing or that thing, or if I could just, man, if I could just win the lottery. By the way, that's not just within reach. That's like way out of your reach. But that's how we think, right? If I could just get that thing I don't have, it would complete me. It would make me so happy. So think about the children of Israel. They're standing outside the tabernacle and there's just a few feet away, right? Just a few feet away, there's God. the Creator, Jehovah, Yahweh. He's right there. He's just on the other side of that curtain. But I can't get to him. Man, how much would it change my life if I could just get to him? So guess what? We get to him. Right? That thing that was always just out of reach for the Israelites, whether it was just on the other side of that tent or just on the other side of that stone wall, it was just out of reach. If I could just reach it, change my life forever. And now the irony is today we sit here with that easily in reach. And do you even care? Does it even matter to you? Are you now fixated on trying to reach for something different that's going to fix all your problems? I'm going to ask the praise team to come and lead us in our communion song this morning. And as they do that, I want you to think about what it must have been like to have been one of the children of Israel and to have God so close, you could see the clouds, you could feel the heat from the fire. He was just there, but out of reach. And God went through this incredibly long process that we're studying to redeem us so that he wouldn't be out of reach anymore. And so now that God, that Creator, is totally within your reach. He's right there. And the only thing stopping you from being able to be in personal, physical contact and relationship with that God is you. There's no tent. There's no curtain. There's no stone wall. There is nothing in your way except you.